This is the BBC.
Our great life has been described as someone who was a groundbreaker, a pioneer, someone who ruffled feathers and shook up male-dominated sport. Rachel Hayhoe Flint, who died in January this year, epitomised women's cricket in England for more than a generation, bringing it respectability and a higher profile than it had ever enjoyed. And nominating Hayhoe Flint as her great life choice is my guest, Dame Helena Morrissey, who, too, has made it to the top of her career in a male-dominated world, the City. She's founder of the 30% Club, a campaign group whose aim is to get a minimum of 30% women on FTSE 100 boards. And now she's head of personal investing at Legal & General Investment Management, a huge British multinational financial services company whose headquarters are in London. Dame Helena, I see the parallels between you and your great life, both working in environments that have made it hard for women to be accepted as equals. Is that the reason for your making this choice?
It is the main reason. I mean, I admire women who both, you know, get to the top of their own game but do something to help other women. And from everything I have been able to gather about Rachel Hayhoe Flint, that's what she did. She didn't flinch when there was a problem. She just made something happen around it. And I admire that. I also had the opportunity to see her mischievous sense of humour. And I like people who do things with a smile and who are genuinely inspiring rather than very sort of, I suppose, worthy about what they're doing. She's had a great personality from what I could see.
You said you had the opportunity to see her mischievous sense of humour. In what sense?
So we almost shared the stage once. This was in 2015 at something called the Game Changer Awards. And this was for women who have done something to pioneer and make things easier for women in sport. Now, I have a very tenuous link with sports. I am, as CEO formerly of Newton Investment Management, led the charge to sponsor the women's boat race between Oxford and Cambridge and to make sure that that event was covered by the BBC at the same and took place on the same day over the same course as the men's. Rachel was on the platform just before I went and collected my award. She was a panelist. You know, it started slightly challengingly because they had set these ridiculous high stools up that they often do at these conferences. And most of us, especially in a skirt, can't clamber on them and it's all very undignified. And she was tiny. They couldn't help her up to the stool, but instead she just laughed that off. We had been asked not to wear high heels because of something about the flooring. So she joked, well, if only you'd let me wear my stilettos, and got the whole thing diffused.
Are you crazy about cricket too?
Well, not especially. No, I have to admit that I'm not an expert. I sort of gone in sideways to learn a bit more about women's cricket, and obviously has been phenomenal. England winning the World Cup this year and making Rachel Hayhoe Flint proud of, you know, what she, you know, her legacy.
One of the big questions in the issue of pushing for equality is what's the best approach? And Rachel Hayhoe Flint set about the formidable task of persuading the MCC, the Marylebone Cricket Club, to admit women as members, which in the end she succeeded in doing. Was her approach there, do you think, confrontational or gentle?
Ultimately, she did win through quite a, not necessarily gentle, but just a very straightforward, not militant, sort of confrontational approach by just saying, you know, I've got to the top of my game, played cricket for such a long time, I would just like to be a member of this club. And making a very straightforward case that apparently brought the membership around. But my own approach has been very much to collaborate with men, to work with men, to hopefully get them to want what we want and see that it's a good thing to progress. But that's not always the case. I understand there were quite a lot of MCC members who were very antagonistic towards her efforts.
Let's now bring into the discussion today's expert witness, Dr. Raf Nicholson, whose PhD focused on the history of women's cricket. She now teaches history at Queen Mary University of London, and she's a writer on the women's game. Raf, did Rachel Hayhoe Flint turn women's cricket on its head single-handedly?
She turned not only women's cricket on its head, but the sport of cricket generally. There were just so many kind of new innovations that she brought to the sport. The first ever Cricket World Cup in 1973, bringing a whole different dimension to media coverage of women's sport. And in terms of the men's game, bringing in female members to membership of the MCC. Was it her single-handedly. Well, that's, you know, I don't think anyone ever does anything single-handedly. And I think what Helena was saying kind of rang true about her absolute humour and her force of personality. And I think that that really, really helped women's cricket at a time when it was very much hidden in the shadows. It wasn't very much known about. And what Rachel did was, by having this kind of force of personality, she forced people to pay attention to the women's game.
She said this: "It was no use going in with a strident attitude, saying, 'I'm a woman. I demand the right that after 204 years you have a woman member.'" She's talking about the MCC here. She said, "I just chat to people, get them on my side, with a light-hearted sense of humour, even though it's a very serious matter you're dealing with. And eventually you have people supporting you." Does that describe the woman whom you've studied?
Yeah, absolutely. And the woman who I actually had the pleasure of meeting, I interviewed her for my PhD a few years ago. And I remember being very nervous, knowing that she had an incredibly busy schedule, but she was incredibly generous with her time. She took me for tea on the terrace at the House of Lords. This was when she'd become a Conservative peer later in life. And everyone from the kind of the waiter to the doorman knew her. She was chatting to them. She was cracking jokes. She was a very witty, humorous, generous, warm person. And just a kind of small anecdote to sort of demonstrate that sense of humour, it said that when she met the Duke of Edinburgh while she was England captain, he asked her about the protection that women wore to play cricket. And she kind of said, "Oh, well, we don't wear coconut shells, if that's what you mean." So she was very funny.
I heard another version of that too. And apparently when she was asked, did women wear sort of equivalent of cricket boxes? And she said, "Yes, we call them manhole covers." Which, when you hear that, Jay, it's kind of hard not to stop chuckling.
How developed was the women's game when she was a young woman in the 1960s?
Well, it was very much a male-dominated sport then. It was very much seen as a man's game. She was actually quite lucky to have been able to play at school, because most head teachers in the 1950s, when she was at school, actually banned girls' cricket. They thought it was unladylike.
Banned it?
Yes. It was seen as kind of, you know, not something that didn't advance girls socially in the way that tennis did. And it was just, it was still very much viewed as a kind of male game.
It occurs to me that a lesser person would have felt daunted. Have you felt daunted, Helena? Did you at the beginning just sometimes think, I'm just not going to get anywhere with this?
Oh, definitely. I mean, when I started the 30% Club, but initially I got, you know, letters back from chairman, which borderline sort of hate mail, really, and saying, "Don't interfere. This is not your business. This is a women's issue, not a business issue." And there were many occasions where I thought, why am I bothering? Because, you know, this was something I was doing on top of a big job. I have a big family. You know, it was definitely a sort of voluntary. But I did it because I felt that it was a need, and that actually we would have better businesses, better boards. And that just is something, you know, I'm sort of driven to do that sort of thing rather than sort of choosing it to be like that. But yes, there was definitely resistance.
That's interesting, Helena, because I think Rachel faced the same kind of attitudes when she applied for membership of the MCC in 1991. I certainly think throughout the early 90s, there was a lot of vitriol directed against her for what was seen as quite an outrageous move. But what she was really seeking to do was to try and transform an organisation that kind of had an image, a public image of being very stuffy and elitist, and she was trying to change that, and she did ultimately succeed in that.
But society was changing, cultural attitudes were changing, and to some extent the wind of the times was in her sails. That's fair to say, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that is fair to say by the 1990s, yes. But I do think that the MCC was kind of one of the last bastions of masculinity,
yes,
in England. It would be fair to describe it like that. And if it hadn't been for her actually having the audacity to apply for membership in 1991, it would have taken a great deal more time to actually effect that change of getting women in.
I guess the city was one of the last bastions of male.
Definitely. I mean, I had my first child in 1991, and when I returned to work, passed over for promotion, and I asked, you know, what did I need to do to, you know, secure the promotion? And they said, "Oh, well, there's nothing wrong with your performance. It's just a bit of doubt over your commitment because you've just had a baby." So I think it's easy for us to think, well, society was changing. You know, it maybe was she was pushing on an open door. We were pushing on open doors. But actually, it's only been changing because of people like Rachel Hayhoe-Flint that actually have pushed harder than people would have been sort of naturally inclined to accept. We would have moved much more slowly.
Did she come from a sporting background, right, Raf?
Yes, she did. So she was born in 1939 in Wolverhampton to parents Geoffrey Hayhoe and Roma Crocker, who were both PE teachers. They actually moved to Wolverhampton.
Physical education, yeah.
Yes. Mm. They actually moved to Wolverhampton to teach PE. And so, yeah, very much growing up, her parents were supportive of her playing sport. Although not initially cricket, it was all hockey and netball to begin with. But in 1954, she was actually lucky enough to be taken on a school trip to see the New Zealand women's cricket team who were here on tour. And she saw them play at Edgbaston against England. And that really sparked off her interest in cricket. And then she went back to school and ensured that a school team was formed. And then it kind of went on from there, really.
She wrote in her autobiography, "I was never the dizzy teenage girl for whom the only important thing in life was to find a boyfriend and cling on to him. Sport was obviously her great passion, and here she is talking about playing cricket as a child."
As soon as we got home from school, we played cricket either in the road. It was safe to play in the road. In fact, I remember when I was about 7 or 8, the police came down the road and cleared all the boys away and took their names and said, "You can't play cricket in the street." And I was standing there and they didn't take my name. And I was a bit hurt about this. So I went up and tugged this copper's jacket and said, "Excuse me, sir, I was playing cricket." Well, he said, "Oh, girls don't play cricket." So, you know, it was even there right at the age of 7 or 8.
What did she do after she left school?
She made the decision to go to physical education college. So she ended up at Dartford College of Physical Education, which is now part of Greenwich University. So she was very much following in her parents' footsteps. It was something that a lot of England female cricketers ended up doing because it was something that you could easily combine continuing to play cricket with your career. I mean, you had to do that because there wasn't any money in the game. And then she became a PE teacher, and initially she was juggling her England cricket career with teaching PE.
Helena, as an amateur sport, the women couldn't. They had jobs and they couldn't just do it. That must have been a huge difficulty.
Yes, and again, she personally took upon herself to raise money so that they could play. And she raised a huge amount of sponsorship, I think £4,000 in the early 1970s, which was a very large sum of money then. I think she got a sponsorship deal from Marks and Spencer's very early on as well, well before any kind of, you know, now we have commercial sponsorship in a number of women's sports. And actually, I think when you look back at what, again, Rachel Hayhoe Flynn did, she just sort of saw a problem and just, you know, solved it. And she wasn't going to let anything get in the way, which, again, you know, for my mind is a great mark of someone's, you know, character and sheer force of personality.
When did she get her first big break?
It was to South Africa in 1960-61. Yeah. And she had a brilliant time. And in the second test match at Johannesburg, she hit her first international 50. So it was quite a success for her personally.
She moved eventually from teaching to journalism. How did that come about?
She tells the story of when she first was playing, I think, an international match, and it was against New Zealand. She scored a century and she bought all the Sunday newspapers the next day to read all about herself. And there was, I think, one tiny mention sort of under the bowls sort of section. And she said, because perhaps they thought we bowled underarm or something. And so she decided, well, she should write about it. So she became a journalist. So again, she's very can-do. And the spirit of people who are just can-do, okay, no one's doing this, it's a problem, I'm going to solve it. I mean, I just love that.
It started when that first series, when I was captain, I was most annoyed because I scored a century on the first day of my first test match as captain, and being the shy, modest introvert that I am, I went out and bought all the Sunday papers the next day to read about my wonderful innings, and I couldn't find a line anywhere, and I was a bit niffed about this. And I thought, there's a mission here to let people know that we do play cricket, and I wanted people to know about us.
Perhaps it comes down to force of personality, because she managed to get herself a gig on the Wolverhampton Express and Star. That was her first kind of gig in journalism in the mid-1960s, and then by 1967 she talked herself into doing some writing for the Daily Telegraph, and then that, when they went off on tour to Australia and New Zealand in 1968-69, she would be out playing cricket all day, captaining the team in the field, and then she would rush off the pitch, write some copy and send that back to England, and that was appearing in the Daily Telegraph and various other newspapers.
I heard her say this, that when she played really well, she wrote a lovely account of her performance, and when she didn't play so well, she didn't mention anything. So she was quite cunning about that too.
Yes.
She was by this stage getting quite a bit of public notice for what she was doing. She was becoming a national figure.
She was, and I think it's fair to describe her as the first women's cricket celebrity.
You're listening to Great Lives with me, Matthew Paris. I'm joined by my guest, Helena Morrissey, who's nominating her hero, Rachel Hayhoe Flint. We're also joined by Dr. Raf Nicholson. Our Great Life was instrumental in pulling together the first Women's Cricket World Cup. I want to hear a bit more about this.
She was very much the brains behind it, although it wasn't, initially, it wasn't her idea. So she'd got Sir Jack Hayward on board with...
A wealthy businessman and philanthropist.
Yeah, and he suddenly said, why don't we have a World Cup? There'd never been a World Cup of cricket.
Any cricket? No, not men's cricket.
This was ahead of the men, so I think we need to note that she didn't just sort of wait for the men to go first. She was pioneering.
No, absolutely. It was a huge undertaking because it had never been done before. And Rachel kind of was slightly concerned that he wasn't really sure of the cost implications. And she said, kind of, how much do you think it will cost? And he said, oh, probably about £30,000, which was a huge amount of money. It took place in England in 1973. She was going around putting up banners. She was obviously writing about it in the newspapers, being interviewed about it. And it was a difficult undertaking because it was the first Cricket World Cup. Ultimately, it was seen to be very successful for the women's game. It got a lot of media attention. England won, and Rachel was, you know, captaining England and hit a half century in the final, which was played at Edgbaston, which is interesting in itself because she tried to get Lords to host the final of that inaugural 1973 World Cup, and they'd said no, they weren't interested in hosting a women's game.
But it was all such a success that 2 years later, the men copied.
So. Yeah, exactly. Absolutely.
Well, on a personal front, we've just been talking about her as a woman's pioneer and as a cricketer. Did she have a private life? Did she marry?
Well, she did marry, and that's how she became from Rachel Hayhoe to Rachel Hayhoe Flint.
Yeah.
She and her husband had one son, and she became stepmom to his three children as well.
And I think there was a concern for her personally that she wouldn't ever marry because she felt like it would be problematic for a man to put up with her disappearing around England and around the world to play cricket. But she solved that by marrying Derek Flint, who himself had played county cricket for Warwickshire. And I think they actually met while playing squash.
Was she a homely sort of person, cooking and all that sort of stuff?
Not at all, no. She's kind of, you know, quite proud of the fact that she wasn't the type to just settle down at home with Ben and her stepchildren. She, in terms of looking after Ben, she did occasionally bring him along to matches. She kind of said to me when I asked her about it, when I interviewed her, she said, oh, he had a great childhood. It was all my teammates kind of feeding him crisps and pop and et cetera. And he absolutely loved it. But there was certainly a sense of kind of shared responsibility for childcare with Derek, which I guess at that time was actually quite radical.
Throughout her career, she was rocking the boat. She already said she wanted to haul Lords before the Equal Opportunities Commission for not allowing the women's cricket team to play there. Raf, could you explain what the rules were at Lords? It's an arcane business, isn't it?
Absolutely. So women were not allowed in the pavilion at Lords, with the exception of the Queen. This was obviously right up until 1999 when the first women members
were allowed. Not allowed at all?
They were allowed to go along.
Yes.
They were allowed to enter the ground.
Yes.
But the pavilion was kind of seen as a sacred all-male space. And, you know, during that campaign that Rachel staged in the 1990s, there were lots of MCC members saying, oh, you know, our club will be ruined if women are allowed to enter the pavilion. There'll be the noise of knitting needles and they won't pay any attention to the cricket. And, you know, that was the general feeling. And the idea of women therefore playing on this kind of hallowed turf was just, unthinkable. The Women's Cricket Association had been trying to get a game at Lords since the 1920s. Years and years, decades and decades, without success.
You two both know more about cricket than I do, so tell me what the long room is at Lords, because there's a story about her in the long room.
It was the success of the World Cup in 1973 that convinced the MCC eventually in 1976 to allow England women to play for the first time at Lords. They were playing Australia in a one-day international. And Rachel was captaining the side. She won the toss and she deliberately chose to field first because she decided she wanted to be the first captain, the first female captain to lead a team out onto that kind of hallowed turf. But nobody had told her that whether women were allowed to pass through the long room on their way out to the pitch. You know, it was still over two decades away from female members of the MCC. Yeah. And so therefore there was a kind of nervousness that Rachel felt about going into that space because it was a very kind of sacred male space. So she decided that when she led her team down, she was going to have to take them out round the side door onto the pitch. It's a much longer way round. And the problem was that they all the members were expecting them to be going through the long room. So they were all there waiting to applaud. And then they suddenly see them going round out through the side door onto the pitch and everyone's slightly baffled.
And clearly in this situation, someone should have said, you know, we're looking forward to you walking through and clarified it since it hadn't been done before. But they...
No, they when they next came back out, they did come through the long room. So it was all OK in the end.
The reality is that although it sounds preposterous in some ways, some of these issues, it's hard for us to imagine, I think, and this is not that long ago, that these things were happening just down the road.
Raf, would we be right to get the impression that she now carried all before her and she sailed into calmer waters for the second part of her life?
No. In fact, the biggest kind of controversy of her life was ahead of her. We haven't mentioned her amazing innings, actually, in the summer of 1976 against the Australians at the Oval. She batted for 8.5 hours across 2 days of the Test match at the Oval to save the match and the series. To draw that game. And it was an incredible inning. She finished on 179. Then you fast forward a year, July 1977, she's summoned to a meeting of the England selectors and told that she's having the England captaincy removed from her. And it was a huge blow and a massive shock, really.
Why? Why did they do it?
Well, we've talked about her very much kind of becoming the face and the voice of women's cricket, becoming, you know, securing a level of personal fame. And I think that there was certainly some disquiet amongst the rest of the Women's Cricket Association in terms of that level of fame that she was achieving. There were a lot of people, it has to be said, doing very hard work for women's cricket kind of behind the scenes who didn't have such a public profile. Rachel kind of suggested that perhaps there was an element of jealousy there. It's very difficult to kind of justify the decision through any cricketing reason, because as I say, she was kind of at the height of her powers, really. So there's been some rumours that have kind of cropped up in my research that have suggested that she was earning a little bit of money through cricket, and that was that would have been very controversial. In the 1970s, because the Women's Cricket Association were kind of diehard amateurs. They felt that if you were earning money, it was kind of sullying their pure amateur ethos, really.
How hurt was she being dropped from the captaincy?
It was devastating, particularly given that she had no cricketing reason, as Raf's already said, to, and so therefore would have felt it was a personal judgment that was being made against her. And I mean, the fact that people have setbacks, and obviously then she went on to do other great things and didn't give up and didn't lose her spark. I mean, I think that the idea that you have, you know, there's no such thing as, you know, success in a straight line, a very important message for people when they're, you know, reading about somebody after the fact, it all looks so easy. But then at the time, you know, there are setbacks.
Yeah, absolutely. Particularly as she didn't just have the captaincy removed. They went on and then didn't select her for that Winter's World Cup in India, which, again, the reasoning seems very strange. And I don't think that it's ever quite come out exactly what the reasoning was.
You described it, or some described it, as jealousy. But I wonder whether it wasn't just sometimes a bit of irritation, that it was just all Rachel, Rachel, Rachel. Can't you understand that irritation?
Yes, I can understand that irritation. She kind of did become the face and the voice of women's cricket. So, yes, I can understand it.
It's a sort of damned if you do, damned if you don't, isn't it? Because she wouldn't have been able to achieve such progress for the women's game if she hadn't done what she'd done. And yet ultimately people do, you know, I think care or get, have a problem if people's own personality is bigger than the rest of the team.
And if the intention had been to slap her down, it had the opposite effect, because the slapping of her down itself became a big and famous event.
It did, yeah. The WCA were absolutely vilified in the press. So Jack Hayward withdrew his financial support. So it had a negative kind of practical impact. And it just, you know, the press absolutely sided with Rachel. So it really backfired as a decision.
Well, the reality was that in all her time as captain of the England side, as I understand it, she didn't lose a match, or they didn't lose a match.
They didn't lose a test match,
didn't
yes.
lose a test match, yeah. Which, you know, is a pretty enviable record.
Yes. So something perhaps slightly less enviable, that the last thing in her career I wanted to ask you about was going out to play in South Africa when South Africa was off limits, as it were. Was that a mistake?
She didn't think it was, obviously. And I think we need to think back to the kind of mentality of the 1980s. There were a lot of rebel, as we term them, rebel tours to South Africa. In terms of the women's game, Rachel felt strongly that in order for women's cricket to kind of be maintained in South Africa, it was necessary for the English players to maintain some form of contact there. And she also kind of felt that sport and politics were separate. And she described apartheid as sort of strange and sad, but not really any of our business.
We might look at it through a different lens now and think that was effectively sort of supporting what was going on there. But I think that you can admire somebody and not necessarily agree with everything that they did.
Did she continue to be as successful when she was no longer famous for cricket?
Inspirational is used far too often and widely and doesn't always apply. But actually, I found her inspirational when I heard her on the stage a couple of years ago.
So a great life in every respect, Helena.
From my point of view, yes, we should recognise her for all her pioneering work off the pitch as well as on.
Before we end, let's just listen to her talking about hitting a famous six.
The groundsman at the Oval didn't quite like women playing cricket there, so he shoved us right to the complete edge of the hold square, as it's called, where all the wickets are cut. And so the boundary was about 60 yards to the one side and 380 to the other, and it wasn't half a long way to run and pick the ball up in that direction. So it was, we needed runs quickly, and I thought, oh, it's a bit of fun, and dance down the wicket and whack it over the boundary. And I didn't know it was the first six hit by a woman in Test history after, what, 30 or 40 years of Test cricket.
My thanks to my guest, Dame Helena Morrissey, on nominating her great life, Baroness Hayhoe Flint, and to our expert witness, Raph Nicholson. Goodbye.